Welcome to Scientifica, the premier podcast where the latest scientific discoveries are discussed in the context of their apologetic significance to the Christian faith.
This is Average Joe Aguirre, joined today by members of our scholar team, astronomer Hugh Ross, biochemist Fuzz Rana, and astrophysicist Jeff Swearing. They will be sharing exciting research today from the front lines of the scientific journals and discussing the apologetic implications. You will hear from each in roundtable fashion today, and we've already tossed the dice. We did that beforehand, so we've spared injury. It's a small table here, and you guys are pretty coordinated, but not terribly coordinated, so we didn't want to risk anybody getting hurt there.
Is that why we have foam dice?
Yes, they are foam. They bounce around, and you guys are quite valuable to the ministry and to all of us. We don't like to see that happen around here, so we're grateful. In any case, Fuzz is going first, Jeff second, and Hugh third. So welcome to each of you, and you've got some exciting research to discuss and bring to the table. So we will hear Fuzz's discovery first, and as we have come to learn, these are great discoveries that our listeners have come to appreciate for the apologetic value, and we trust that you are learning to share these and the apologetic implication and importance of these as well. Fuzz, as I looked at this discovery, it looks like it has to do with wire-like behavior of DNA. That sounded intriguing.
Yes, yeah. Well, and I guess if I'm going first, I'm the warm-up act, and so Jeff and Hugh will progressively get better as is wont.
Is that because you're a progressive creationist?
Oh, there we go. We need some drum rolling there.
So anyway, so hopefully I can.
I thought you started with the biggest number, and then it's all just going to go downhill.
Yeah, so hopefully I can get the crowd warmed up here.
Indeed.
With this discovery.
All right,
but the best is yet to come. But you know, this is a paper that I want to talk about that was published recently in Science by a research team from Caltech, headed up by a chemist by the name of Jacqueline Barton. And I can remember reading a work by Jacqueline Barton in the early 1990s when I was finishing up my postdoc and beginning my career at Procter & Gamble, and have always been fascinated with her work in the behavior of DNA, as you mentioned, as a wire. And this work that she's published just recently has some really, I think, important implications for those of us who are interested in using biochemistry to build a case for a creator's role in bringing about the origin and the design of life.
So that's the key right there.
Yeah, so it's going to allow us to make actually a multi-pronged design argument. And, you know, I think it's safe to say that DNA is an incredibly remarkable molecule. If you look at DNA's function in the cell, it's primarily data storage. It stores all the information that the cell needs to carry out all of its activities, to produce the machines that function inside the cell, to carry out the cell's activity. In fact, DNA even contains information that produces proteins that regulate the expression of that information during the course of the cell cycle and even during the course of development. So it's a very sophisticated data storage system with a very sophisticated system for elaborating the expression of that information as well. In fact, scientists are now looking at DNA as a digital storage medium, as a way to archive vast amounts of data that would be data that you wouldn't access on a regular basis but would have in long-term storage. And that highlights just how remarkable DNA is as an information storage system. Well, DNA has other really interesting properties as well that people that are working in nanotechnology are interested in taking advantage of. And nanotechnology is an engineering discipline where the goal is to build molecular scale devices that are literally comprised of atoms and molecules that kind of assemble into super molecular structures that can carry out different tasks. And one of the things that you need to do when you build nano machines is you need to have scaffolding to build the machines around. And people realize by the nature of the way in which DNA interacts with itself through what's called complementary base pairing, that you can actually take advantage of that to build very elaborate geometric shapes with DNA in a laboratory to form scaffolding again for nanotechnology, and even to build kind of machines that can do some interesting things, again, by taking advantage of the capacity of DNA to form these geometric shapes. Now, this program is called work in DNA origami, where you're folding the DNA. Okay. But it doesn't really have any kind of biological relevance. It's just simply an interesting property of DNA that, again, allow nanoscientists to take advantage of it. A remarkable property, but nevertheless, it doesn't have biological relevance. Well, in the
so do they have the capacity to go in and say, all right, you got this DNA, and you know it's got a capacity to fold and do things. Can they manipulate it so that it folds a specific way? Is that what they're talking?
Yes,
that's what you're talking about.
Yeah,
just what kind of chemicals, the environment you put around it, that sort of stuff.
Yes, and then how you work the sequence and that type of thing, you can create these folds and bends. And
so it's so it's also engineering the DNA sequence so that it does things a particular way.
Yes, okay. Exactly. Now, that has nothing to do with what I want to talk about. It just...
Well, but it's cool, though.
Yeah, it is. It is cool, but it highlights, again, the way in which people are looking to use DNA and nanotechnology. Well, this brings us to Jacqueline Barton, because in the 1990s, she had this insight that DNA could function like a wire. And to appreciate what's going on there, we need to review the structure of DNA. DNA is comprised of two molecular strands, and each of those strands is built from subunit molecules that are linked together in a head-to-tail fashion. And then the two strands come together and interact with each other so that the backbones of the strands are like the uprights of a ladder. The side groups that come off the strands are like the rungs of a ladder. So DNA has this ladder architecture. And then if you twist it, you get the well-known DNA double helix. Well, it turns out that the portion of the subunit molecules that forms the rungs of the ladder are called nucleobases. And there are two different categories of nucleobases, purines and pyrimidines. Purines are a 6 and a 5-membered ring that are fused together. A purine is a 6-membered ring. And the nature of the chemical bonding in the nucleobases is such that all the atoms are in the same plane. So it has what chemists call a planar geometry. And the type of bonding is called aromatic bonding. It doesn't mean the compound smell. It's just a description for the type of bonding. Well, that kind of bonding creates an electron cloud above and below the plane of the rings, okay? So now if you think about those rungs of the ladder stacked on top of each other in the DNA molecule, what happens is the electron clouds from one rung will overlap with electron clouds from the rungs below it and above it. And so in terms of chemical bonding, that creates a molecular orbital that runs through the entire interior of the DNA molecule. And you can think of that molecular orbital now as being essentially an atomic level or atomic scale wire. And so
So because the clouds overlap, electrons are just free to move very easily from one cloud to the other.
Yes, exactly.
And so therefore you get electrons.
Yeah, that's a great clarifying point. So what Jacqueline Barton did in the 1990s, which was brilliant, was took a DNA double helix and she attached two organometallic complexes to the ends. And those are kind of organic materials with a metal center. And it was ruthenium on both ends. And so she could blast it with a light on one end, eject the electron, it would go into the DNA wire, pop out at the other end, reduce the other organometallic complex, which would give off a flash of light. So she could actually measure the time it took for the electron to flow through the DNA molecule. And lo and behold, it moved so fast, faster than anybody expected, that there looks like there's a quantum tunneling effect going on there. So it's almost like an instantaneous transfer. Hmm. So now you've got DNA that can work like a wire. And so people are literally looking since the 1990s at ways to build molecular scale electronics with DNA wires. Hmm. And there's other applications for this. Now, this is all well and good, but the big question is this biologically relevant? And so it really took Jacqueline Barton's team almost 15 years to discover an instance where this phenomena was actually happening inside the cell. And in 2008 forward, they've been studying what are called basic scission repair enzymes. These are enzymes that will recognize damage on the DNA, will cut out the damage, and then replace the damaged DNA with the appropriate DNA subunits to repair the damage. That's why the name is called excision repair, cutting out the damage and replacing it with the right amount or the right type of subunit molecule. And the big question is, how on earth does the cell screen its genome to look for damaged DNA? And she was studying E. coli, the bacteria E. coli, that has a genome of about 4.6 million genetic letters, but there's probably a couple handfuls of these basic scission repair enzymes in the cell. And how do just 10, 12, 15 of these actually survey this vast amount of genome looking for the damage and then repairing it?
Well, so is it going to be the same number in the human genome, which has, you know, 3 billion or so? Or
it would probably be roughly comparable. I don't know.
So proportionately, or it's going to probably scale with the size of the genome. Okay.
I don't know that people have, I'm sure people have studied it. I'm just simply not aware.
Fair enough. So.
But Jacqueline Barton's work has been primarily in E. coli.
Right.
But what happens is these basic scission repair enzymes have what's called an iron-sulfur cluster. So it's kind of a cluster, an organic metallic cluster that's comparable to the ruthenium complexes Jacqueline Barton attached to the ends of DNA. And so they can basically give up electrons and receive electrons. So what happens is these basic scission repair enzymes hop along the DNA, and when they bind to the DNA and they don't have an electron, they're permanently they're attached and they can't dissociate. But then when another one binds to the DNA that does have an electron, shoots the electron down the wire, and then that one that doesn't have the electron receives it, it hops off, moves along to another place on the DNA. So you have these basic scission repair enzymes hopping on and off the DNA, sending electrons back and forth, and that's how they survey the genome for damage. Because if there's damage to the DNA, the double helix gets distorted, the wire is interrupted, and there's no flow of current. And so this is a really cool instance where this DNA wire is actually critical for the repair process.
So it's using the electrical conductivity as its test basis to see how good whether the structure of the DNA is intact.
Right. So, I mean, it's comparable to going up to an outlet and sticking one of those testers into it to see if the outlet is working. If the light goes on, the outlet's working, and if it doesn't, you've got damage to the electrical infrastructure. So
it's like it's sending a signal, and then that one jumps off and goes to the next place where there's damage.
It doesn't even necessarily have to be damage.
It's just hopping
on and off, passing electrons back and forth. But then when the current is interrupted because of damage, those excision repair enzymes can't come off the DNA. And then at that point, they can now fine-tune their search by walking along the DNA, finding the damage, and then repairing it. Now, this new work that she just published shows that the same thing is going on, or same phenomena is being exploited in DNA replication. In DNA replication, you have the double helix unwinding, exposing two single strands that serve as templates that the cell will then utilize as a way to build the complementary strand. And as a net result, you'll have two double helices that result from the single parent double helix. And that process involves reading position by position and adding the appropriate base along the way, the appropriate subunit. Well, that process begins with an enzyme called primase that lays down an RNA primer, and then that RNA primer serves as the starting point for another enzyme called DNA polymerase to actually produce the DNA replication process. The DNA polymerase and the primase both have an iron-sulfur cluster. And it turns out that people were trying to understand what triggers the primase to stop adding RNA primer and dissociate from the DNA. Well, what happens is when the DNA polymerase binds to the DNA. It sends an electron through the wire, the RNA-DNA duplex wire. When the primase binds that electron, it dissociates from the DNA, and now the DNA polymerase takes off, and away replication goes. So the point here is that this wire phenomena of DNA is actually not only involved in the repair process, but is also involved in the replication process. So it seems like it's a property that's being exploited by the cell. So now, how does this relate to the case for a creator? Well, first of all, I think it just highlights how ingenious not only the structure of DNA is, but how the cell's machinery will utilize those properties to carry out very important operations in the cell. And in fact, the ingenuity is so great, and the wire properties of DNA are so phenomenal that it's actually inspiring a nanotechnology. Mm-hmm. It's something that we're taking advantage of, and that is something like I like to call the bio-inspiration argument for design. If we're utilizing designs in biology to inspire engineering, it highlights the elegance of those designs that are, I think, befitting of a creator, but also it raises questions about, is this something that evolution can really produce, mm-hmm. given its unguided, historically contingent? It doesn't make sense that that kind of a process would produce these kind of elegant systems that have properties that are so remarkable that it really is inspiring us to the next generation of electrical technology. Mm-hmm. But also, it, I think, allows us to make a watchmaker argument, because one of the things I find fascinating is there are so many biological systems and biochemical systems that look like human designs, that have the same property as human design. So you could use that to build an argument that if our designs have certain properties and we see those designs in biochemistry, then if our designs require a mind, the designs in the cell require a mind as well. And so you could use this to build a watchmaker argument, or to complement the watchmaker argument you can develop, again, with the remarkable similarity between biochemical systems and human designs. In fact, in my book, The Cell's Design, I kind of elaborate on how biochemistry can be used to revitalize the watchmaker argument. But in that book, I advanced something called the watchmaker prediction. I said, if basically the cell's chemistry is really the work of a mind, that as we develop new technologies, we're actually going to find that the new technologies we develop already have representation inside the cell. Hmm. And at the time that I wrote the book, the work by Jacqueline Barton that was published in 2008 had not been reported, where she was showing this DNA wire property actually has biological significance. And lo and behold, after the book was published and I made that watchmaker prediction, we're now seeing that this technology that's being developed with the wire properties of DNA is actually technology that was already in use inside the cell. We just didn't recognize it as such. Mm-hmm. And so that it actually satisfies the watchmaker prediction. So in a sense, there's kind of like three interrelated arguments that one can make for the work of a creator in bringing about the origin and the design of life. Again, the fact that this DNA, the DNA properties inspire new technology, the fact that we can make a watchmaker argument with it, and the fact that this is a satisfied prediction that flows out of what, again, I call the watchmaker prediction. So anyway, it's just incredibly cool stuff, and I just have great admiration for Jacqueline Barton and just the quality of the work that she's consistently produced in her lab at Caltech over the last 25, nearly 30 years. She really has pioneered, I think, some remarkable insights into the structure and behavior of DNA that are going to have, I think, very important ramifications in as nanotechnology becomes more and more prominent in terms of the technology that we develop.
Hmm. Yeah, I think, in all honesty, I think you're missing the biggest aspect of design in the cell, in that you take these two things that are wound around each other, and somehow the cell knows how to split those apart without ending up with a big ball of mess. Because I've never figured out how to do that well. I mean, I always try and take strings apart, and it's like it always ends up really messed up and haggard. But
well, you bring that point up, and there's an there are enzymes that will unwind the DNA, and as soon as it's unwound, there are other proteins that bind to it to keep it from basically tangling up. So you have these
singles. It's pretty remarkable. It really
is. Yeah.
So do you call this string theory?
We could. It's the biochemist version of string theory. So anyway, and
the biochemist version actually works. Oh, sorry.
Did I
say that out loud?
Yeah, you did.
But the thing is, I think for people that are listening, these are the types of discoveries that actually get exposure in the science and the news type right. articles. And so if people are aware of these kind of designs and how to connect those designs to the case for a creator, this becomes great water cooler conversation. Who doesn't want to hear about DNA wires? And to be able to link that to, to the idea that there is a creator that brought life into existence is a great way to introduce people to why you're a Christian.
That's an excellent point. Just to buttress your point, it doesn't need buttressing, but as a layperson who has followed the ministry a long time, I'll say this to encourage people. It is hard to track with some of the science discoveries, but as you mentioned there, Fuzz, a common criticism of RTB on the part of skeptics is that you guys are often making really post-dictions and not predictions, but that is not the case there, as you just explained. You said, here's something I predicted in the book. You explained the watchmaker argument, and there it is. Lo and behold, we have a prediction that has come to pass. By the way, RTB is always working on developing its model. Is that correct, Hugh? Would you say?
Yes, and always making predictions.
This model is not complete. We're always adding elements to it, right?
Well, a good model will continue to make predictions of future discoveries.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you for that, Fuzz. That was good. Okay. Well, Jeff, we're going to go on over into your area. And the beginning of the universe always fascinates people, and scientists are always working on proposals to resolve that issue if it hasn't been resolved in everybody's mind yet. And it looks like there's a proposal on the table now regarding creation ex nihilo, which Christians can resonate with, but this looks like it's an information-based proposal, if I got that right.
Yeah, it is. And, I just kind of wanted to bring it out here to kind of outline a little bit of what it says. I think it's got some interesting philosophical points. Also, just has relevance, developing a case for the creator, and it's got just a kind of provocative title. So this is a journal article that a couple of people through social media have brought to my attention. It's published in the journal called Physics of the Dark Universe, and I would say this is a new journal, probably an obscure journal, and it does, in some sense to me, highlight the point that just because something is published in a peer-reviewed journal, or I'll say it this way, not all articles published in peer-reviewed journals carry the same weight. And I don't know.
Is this inspired by Star Wars?
I don't think so. It's a statement that there's a lot of different research going on out there, and there's different, there's some very, I don't want to say obscure, but the level of specificity you can get in certain discussions is pretty high. And so I think this is, Physics of the Dark Universe, talk about dark energy, origin of the universe type stuff, that it's a lot of work going on there. But again, the title of the article is Spontaneous Creation of the Universe Ex Nihilo. And, it's obviously got the provocative title there of, creation ex nihilo, and what do you do with that? And the basic outline of the paper and what's being proposed is they're saying, okay, we've got, Big Bang cosmology, where you start after about 10 to the minus 35 seconds, and it is a phenomenal description of how the universe develops. Why do you end up with the strong, weak nuclear interactions, the electromagnetic force? How do you end up with galaxies, stars, planets? Just a phenomenal description of the universe. But as you continue to push back, you run into a couple of problems. One is that there's this pervasive evidence of a beginning to the universe, which I think is a remarkable thing. And what you end up with is something where you've got this description of the universe where, given the initial conditions, we've got a very good map. This hot, dense state that comes out of the Big Bang, or in the singularity there. but there's nothing in the description of the universe that specifies the initial conditions. And so it's incomplete in that sense. And so, you know, this is a, you know, nothing new. People, you know, this is where the multiverse came about. This is, or, you know, why the multiverse became popular is because it's explaining the beginning of our universe without any sort of special input. You know, it's just the laws of physics, if you will. And so what they're arguing, their basic model is saying that, okay, we've got Big Bang cosmology. It works really well. How can we produce a model of the universe that starts from nothing, has no special initial conditions, but yet ends up with a universe like ours, you know, that connects up and describes things up from the Big Bang on, or connects with that point? And what they're arguing is that information is the ultimate foundation of matter. So matter does not provide information, but information provides matter, if you will. And yeah, that's a little bit of an oversimplification, but that's kind of the basic idea. And so they posit this idea that there is this infinite sea of, they use a specific term for it, nullifying information elements, NIEs. And essentially what it is that you get these nullifying information elements, and because there's an infinite number of them, there's no information there. Because for every combination, there's always something that cancels them out. Mm. And then at some point, there's this spontaneous symmetry breaking, and that's something, a very well-known physics phenomena. That's why you get the electroweak, or the electromagnetic force and the weak nuclear force being different, as there was a spontaneous symmetry breaking. It's, you know, a similar but different example is where, you know, you've got water vapor. As you cool water vapor down, it's got a great deal of symmetry when it's in a gaseous phase. There's no orientation, there's no preferred orientation or specification. But once you cool it down, it goes and it becomes liquid water. And now there's a structure to it. There's a symmetry breaking that happens there. And furthermore, as you continue to cool it down, it'll eventually turn into ice, and that'll have a crystal structure. And there's a very definite, the symmetry is broken. One direction doesn't look the same as the other direction anymore. And so it's a little more complicated, but they're arguing basically that there's this spontaneous symmetry breaking that results in some net increase of information, and that increase of information now ultimately either drives something like inflation, which gives the initial conditions, or it ends up just connecting with Big Bang cosmology after the epoch of inflation somehow. And so it would account for why we have the second law of thermodynamics, why we have the universe starting in such a high entropy state or low entropy state. You know, they argue that there's all these different things that it accounts for. So that's kind of the basic model of what they're laying out. What I find interesting about it is this discussion, one, a recognition that our universe has a beginning. You know, and I think that's a pretty remarkable statement, that they're trying to explain why there's this beginning, or how do we explain that beginning in a way that doesn't require special conditions or something like that. But there's a very definite acknowledgement that our universe has a beginning. And I think that's a remarkable correspondence to the way the Bible describes things. You know, you even see that in the title, the ex nihilo, that out of nothing. Mm-hmm. Now, I think philosophically, if you're going to go in and argue that, you know, we're talking about something from nothing, that, you know, this infinite sea of nullifying information elements is not nothing. You know, so there's philosophical problems, and I think that's something that physicists tend to run afoul of when they do philosophy, is they don't always understand philosophy, myself included. That's why I tend to go talk to philosophy friends when I want to make philosophical statements, but to make sure that I do that right. But, you know, what it seems to me they're doing here is that they're ultimately hypothesizing or stipulating that there is this self-existent eternal state that ultimately gives rise to the universe. And so it's kind of like Lawrence Krauss's universe from nothing. He says it's from nothing, but ultimately there's this quantum vacuum that ultimately generates everything. That's not nothing. It's not nothing in the way a philosopher would define it. It may be nothing in terms of space-time, matter, and energy.
One of the nine kinds.
One of the nine different kinds of nothing. Each one of is something.
It's a proliferation of nothing kinds. I think it was five when I joined the ministry. So
it's up to nine now, Jeff.
Go ahead.
But the other thing that I find interesting in this, as I was thinking about this, and actually just a weird thought occurred to me over the weekend, is, you know, I was thinking about what it is that we define as natural, or you know, kind of we talk about this natural supernatural divide, and where does God intervene? And that's the way a lot of Christians and non-Christians think about it. And one of the things that it occurs to me is, let's just say all of this is right. I mean, I don't know whether this is right or not, but let's just say all this is right. Now we have a quote-unquote natural explanation for the formation of the universe, but it still posits something entirely outside of the universe that brings it into existence. You know, that, you know, you go back to steady-state cosmology when it was proposed, and there was this creation field that generated new matter that, even though we had, I mean, that's something entirely foreign to our way of looking at things, it now became natural because we have, it's got some term and an equation, if you will, that describes it, that there seems to be this relentless addition of, though we have, because we now have an explanation, it's now natural. It's not supernatural anymore. You know, it just kind of really muddies those waters. And I thought that was just kind of an interesting aspect of this discussion, as they're saying our universe has a beginning, and in some sense we can now explain it with the laws of physics, and therefore there's nothing unusual about it. When in reality, what we've done is said, all right, our universe has a beginning. It's something outside the universe is responsible for bringing it into existence, but it's connected with our universe in a way we can describe. And so I think that's a very Christian way to look at things. I mean, there's a God outside of creation who holds everything together, so it's connected, but there's something independent of our universe that exists.
Mm. Sounds like Hebrews 11:3, the universe that we can detect did not come from that which we can detect.
I agreed. I think it's, yeah, it's much like that. And, you know, I do think there's a very naturalistic or a philosophical worldview built into this way of looking at things, in that the ultimate foundation of reality is something that's non-physical, non-personal, and non-temporal. You know, and they're going to say, yeah, that's not the God of the Bible. But, you know, it really is saying that there's something outside of this universe that brought it into existence. And we may have hints at how to describe and talk about it, but we don't have a complete picture of it. And so I just thought that was kind of an interesting discussion. And I don't know where this is going to play out or how this is going to, you know, what the readership of the Physics of the Dark Universe journal is. But I thought it was an interesting discovery, and people had been kind of asking for my comments. And so as I was reading through it, I thought, this has got some interesting philosophical points to it.
Well, it's an ironic title, I mean, because it uses ex nihilo, but it's not really ex nihilo. And Jeff, I'm going to have to revise my talk about 9 different forms of nothing. It's going to be 10 different forms now.
See, we're proliferating nothingness here at RTV.
We are. So.
Yeah. Well, you know, one of the things that I think is interesting is a lot of times when you talk about God creating the universe, the common retort from skeptics is, well, then who created God, right?
Right.
And you know, I know, Hugh, that you've given, I thought, a really good answer in your book, Beyond the Cosmos, but it seems to me that this paper is really highlighting the fact that whether you're a Christian who posits an uncaused creator that brought the universe into existence, or you're an atheist, you still have to posit an uncaused cause to explain the universe. They're just having an impersonal something that's an uncaused cause that's bringing the universe into existence. So nobody gets away from the idea that there has to be something that is uncaused that brings the universe into existence. So to me, it really seems to be an illegitimate rebuttal to a Christian, you know, idea that there's a God that brought everything into being.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a real profound point, and something that has helped me, you know, when I see these things. You know, I remember when I first was reading Guth's book on inflation. It's called The Inflationary Universe. You know, it's talking about how once it starts, it goes forever. They were talking about, well, if it goes forever, maybe it's always been going forever. You know, so it's this idea that there really isn't a beginning. And, you know, I think it's profound that people continually talk about how there's a beginning, and the data seems to keep driving us to that. But then there's a whole lot of people working on saying, how do we explain the beginning? And every one of those explanations that I have seen thus far traces back to something that has just always existed. You know, whether you've got Alex Vilenkin, where the universe kind of pops into existence and doesn't require this or that. Well, that it does require that there is a false vacuum that it's in. Or you've got Lawrence Krauss's Universe from Nothing. Well, there you still have this quantum vacuum. I mean, there's ultimately behind that explanation a self-existent or you know, an eternal reality that is causative. You know, it's not just the laws of physics don't become a description of the universe; they become a prescription for how things are going to happen. You know, and you know, I think to me one of the interesting aspects is that if we're dealing with consciousness, that if consciousness doesn't have a purely physical explanation, that you have to start with consciousness to get consciousness, then your ultimate reality is a self-caused, causative, conscious reality. Well, I mean, that's starting to sound a lot like God. I mean, it's a minimal description of the God of the Bible, if you will. So just seeing how all of those descriptions end up back there is, to me, it's a robust reinforcement that Christianity really does have the best description of things.
Then if you couple that, too, with the idea that there's design in the universe, mm-hmm. and that design is like a fitness to purpose, you know, design and purpose are qualities that come from a personality.
Right, yeah.
So, I mean, that's another way to argue. But I think your point about consciousness is really very powerful, too. You know, because it is a universe where there at least some aspects of the universe have consciousness. And how does that come about?
Right.
All right. Thank you, Jeff. Excellent stuff there. I really appreciate that. We have a consistent theme going here. Hugh, you must be chomping at the bit because I can anticipate what you're already going to be saying here. We're going now back to the very earliest moments that the universe is beginning. You have a series of papers to talk about.
Well, in one sense, it's a sequel to what Jeff talked about, and we didn't even plan this. I mean, right. This is another example of God at work because the Holy Spirit was working here. Because what I want to talk about also has to do with the cosmic beginning. And Jeff, I love what you said, that all the data, all the observations, all the experiments scream that there's a beginning to the universe. And as you and I have taught, atheists get around that and say, well, yeah, everything we can see and measure says there's a beginning, but what about that era where we can't see and measure, the quantum gravity era? Maybe there's some way to escape the beginning there. And you know, a number of scientists said, well, this really isn't science because we have no way of exploring that. You know, who knows what's going on in the quantum gravity era? And I just calculated that if you really want to explore the energy conditions of the quantum gravity era, you would need a particle accelerator 50 times the length of the distance from planet Earth to the farthest quasar that we can observe.
Is that all?
Is that all, right? So chances are we're not going to be able to do that kind of science. But what has been thrilling me in reading the astronomical literature in the last few months, and even today a paper got published, making the point, yeah, we would need a particle accelerator 50 times the length of the distance from here to the most distant galaxy, but there's actually some ways that we can observationally probe what's going on in the quantum gravity era. And it's another example of what's been happening in science apologetics. The more we learn, the more case we see for the Christian doctrine of creation. And this is an example where now we're able to push into the quantum gravity era, and it looks like it really is supporting our Christian worldview. So again, as we push the boundaries, I mean, when I was a young boy studying astronomy, our observational capacity of the universe was about 1/1,000th of a percent of what it is today. We've actually expanded things by a factor of nearly 100,000 times just in my lifetime. Well, I thought we would never be able to probe the quantum gravity era with any kind of observational experiment. They've actually found three distinct ways that can be done, and some of them actually have been done. And one is that a lot of quantum gravity models hypothesize that there's a quantum space-time foam. And you know, almost all the models have some quantum space-time foam operating the quantum gravity era. But a number of astronomers have pointed out
is that the frothiness of the quantum space-time foam will have an observable effect. Namely, that if you've got some, and what I mean by frothiness is just the size of the quantum space-time fluctuations in the space-time fabric, that frothiness will be magnified as light travels from the most distant objects to our telescope. And the shorter the wavelength, the greater the magnification. And so if there is a high degree of frothiness in the quantum space-time foam, it's going to make the images of distant galaxies and quasars blurry. And the shorter the wavelength, the blurrier will be the image. And we've got the capacity with the current telescopes to actually look at these distant objects at short wavelengths and see whether they're sharp or the blurry. And three papers have been published where basically the astronomer said, to our maximum measuring capacity, we see no blurriness. Now, there's an observational limit, I mean, in terms of how sharp we can determine the image to be. But it's basically already such that they've been able to eliminate the entire category of what are called random wonk quantum gravity models. That's been a favorite place for atheists to go to try to find some way to build exotic physics to escape the beginning that is evident everywhere else we can see and observe. That whole class is gone with the observations. And then a month ago, a paper got published where they said, taking advantage of X-ray telescopes and gamma-ray telescopes, now they've only been able to push this out to about a billion light years, but they're able to eliminate virtually all of what are called the holographic quantum gravity models. And this is the one where Sean Carroll and other atheists have been going to try to build these, what they call quantum eternal theorems, where they try to make the universe eternal through speculations of what they think quantum gravity might be. And one astronomer said, I think we've actually eliminated all the quantum or holographic quantum gravity models. Another paper says, well, we've only eliminated the vast majority, that there is an exotic way to try to save that. The potential here, though, is that we could actually push this a lot further by going to shorter wavelengths and going to blazars, because blazars are, you know, give a good strong signal at X-ray and gamma-ray wavelengths.
And actually, blazars are what now?
Well, blazars are basically quasars with gigantic supermassive black holes, you know, coming in at billions of times the mass of the sun. So really big black holes that are feeding voraciously. What I mean by that is they're gobbling up all kinds of gas and stars in their vicinity. And when you gravitationally suck in huge quantities of mass into a supermassive black hole, you get the conversion of matter into energy just outside the event horizon of about 10%. And to give you some idea of a comparison, our star, the sun, is converting matter into energy at a level of about 0.07%. So it explains, why these objects are so incredibly bright at great distances. It's because of the copious amounts of matter that are being converted into energy just outside the event horizon of the supermassive black hole. And so they're saying we can push this observational test much deeper. But remarkably, they've already been able to eliminate the vast majority of quantum gravity models that theoreticians have been playing with. And then just today, a paper got published where they said there's another way we can push or, you know, constrain the boundaries of quantum gravity speculations. And that is if we're lucky enough to discover a pulsar black hole binary. And this would be a pulsar neutron star that's pulsating that would be orbiting a black hole just outside the event horizon. And such a black hole, you know, pulsar black hole binary would actually tell you what's happening at the event horizon of that black hole. And that depends on what kind of quantum gravity is operating there. And so making those kinds of observations, you'll be able to determine which quantum gravity models are viable and which quantum gravity models are not viable. It would actually have the capacity of eliminating another class of quantum gravity models that the observations of the sharpness of distant images would not give you. And so it's quite remarkable that we're able to explore something that is so far beyond the reach of particle physics accelerators.
All right. So what does this tell us then?
It tells us is that the frothiness of the quantum space-time foam is at a very minimal level, and that was a surprise. No one was expecting that the quantum gravity, space-time foam would be that smooth. It's really smooth, and we may be able to show it's even smoother. You know, who knows? But it does eliminate a lot of quantum gravity theories that are being bandied about in journals like Physics Letters B.
Hugh, just a point of clarification, what does the relationship between the smoothness and the frothiness of the quantum foam again have to do with the idea that there may be ways to escape the beginning of the universe?
Well, if you're looking for really exotic physics that overturns the physics of everything we can see, you're going to need a lot of frothiness in this quantum space-time foam. The fact that it's smooth is telling us, well, because what you hear and see in a lot of these papers that are being published by atheist theoretical physicists is this idea that the laws of physics radically break down between 0 and 10 to the minus 43 seconds. Now, I'd argue right at 0, yeah. I mean, we're looking at something radically different. It's the cosmic creation event. That's when physics first comes into play. So, I mean, at some point, they do have an argument that things are radically different. But what you see in a lot of their papers is that as you enter into the quantum gravity era, from where we can measure to where we can't measure, you immediately get this radically different physics. These measurements are telling us that's not what's happening. So,
this time period again is 10 to the minus 40.
We're talking 100 thousandths of a trillionth of a trillionth of a trillionth of a second.
After the
cosmic creation event. So, we're talking about a very tiny era. But it also raises a principle. I mean, I run into a lot of atheists who say, you know what, I'm not going to believe your Christian faith until you can eliminate all possible explanations that can sustain an atheistic worldview. The bottom line is that'll never happen. Because for that to be possible, we'd have to know absolutely everything that's possible to know about the universe. And because we're humans and because we're constrained by the space-time dimensions of the universe and by the laws of physics, we're never going to reach that. In other words, the atheist will always have a loophole. But what this is demonstrating is we're boxing the atheist into a smaller and smaller corner. That should tell you something. Yeah. You know, the more we learn, the more we can see and measure, the more evidence we're gaining for the biblical creation model. Hmm. And so here again, we've been able to push back the frontiers of knowledge or push forward the frontiers of knowledge into an era we thought was impossible.
Yeah.
And as we're doing it, it's basically sustaining our Christian worldview. But if you're saying, hey, can you eliminate all the atheistic arguments? It'll never happen.
Hugh, I have a question. It has nothing to do with apologetics. Jeff, you can weigh in as well. How much money has been spent, if you have any idea, on this brief period that we're talking about, 10 to the minus 43 seconds?
Well, theoretical physicists don't have really expensive equipment. I mean, all you got to do is buy them a good computer. And get them subscriptions to all the journals. And, so you got to pay their salary and their support staff. It's not like trying to sustain particle physicists at CERN, where you got a $10 billion instrument and then $1 billion a year budget. So,
but this is what's this called? Planck time? That,
right.
But we want to spend a lot of money to learn about the very beginning of the universe, right? So, A lot of money has been spent.
I guess kind of an analogy, though, is, if you go, you're talking about the gamma ray observations there. This is done with an instrument that was designed for something else. You know, it was designed to measure the gamma ray sky to see what sort of sources there were, pin them down to what level we can. And then because of how good of an instrument it is, we can now actually use it to do some of these sorts of measurements. So in that sense, there was no, this would have been done, that research almost comes as an add-on to what the justification for the research was.
Unexpected bonus.
You know, and so if you say, all right, we're going to investigate the Planck time, that's kind of equivalent to saying, all right, we're going to go down and measure the core of the Earth. Well, we haven't even made it through the crust yet. So that's, you know, we haven't spent any money to go down to the core because we haven't made it through the crust. Now, there are ways where we can get bits of pieces of information through other things kind of fortuitously, and that's kind of the analogy I would use there.
Yeah.
We've not spent any money to go to the core, but we've been able to get some information because of the other work that we've done. We've not really spent much of any money to figure out what's going on in the Planck time, but because there are people looking at it, you know, doing calculations, and then there are occasions where it touches observations that we have, we get information on it. That's kind of cool.
Okay. Well, the paper that came out today basically said this gives us more motivation to fund LIGO, the Gravity Wave Telescope, and also the space-based Gravity Wave Telescope, and to fund the square kilometer array. I mean, these are expensive instruments, and people are wondering, should we really be funding all these? And basically they're saying, hey, these are instruments that are going to be able to probe the quantum gravity era. And that's exciting, and it's a whole lot cheaper than trying to get the CERN people to make some progress.
Hugh, give me a bottom line again on this, because I think it ties in nicely.
Well, the bottom line is this quantum gravity era that we thought was totally beyond reach of any observations or experiments is now coming within reach through some, amazing observational tools that people hadn't really probed before. And it's basically showing, hey, again, as we push forward the frontiers of knowledge, is providing us with increasing, not decreasing, evidence for our biblical creation worldview.
But this is another example of what you could argue is a fulfilled prediction that is genuinely a prediction as opposed to a retrodiction. Because, I mean, what Hugh's pointing out is a logical entailment of what a biblical creation model would anticipate with regard to anything we could learn about the Planck time. Am I correct,
yeah,
Hugh?
Right. So
yeah. In a book, for example, where would, if somebody said, where did you say that? Where did you predict that? Could you point that out?
Well, there's a general prediction we had more than a theory that, you know, pick any discipline of science. As we push forward the frontiers of knowledge and get a more comprehensive database, it's going to provide increasing evidence for a biblical worldview, not a decreasing evidence.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just one example. I mean, what Fuzz is talking about in terms of looking at the DNA, because what you're talking about, we didn't know about whether or not DNA could operate as a wire that could carry current and the applications. And as we learned about that, it's actually providing us a stronger case for a Christian worldview. So this is ubiquitous.
Yeah.
And, I'm excited because I thought, well, you know, we're never going to be able to probe quantum gravity. There's always going to be metaphysics. That's why people can speculate about it because there's no way to check it out. And lo and behold, we now have a tool that can constrain our ideas.
But you would have predicted, maybe you did, that the laws of physics would hold all the way back to the beginning of the universe.
Yeah, but I also made the comment, if you're talking the quantum gravity era, we really have no idea how those laws will work out. I mean, what I notice is both the Christians and the atheists working on quantum gravity are all humble enough to say, we really don't have a clue how the physics works because, you know, we don't have the measuring capacity. And I would put it along the lines of what happened when Newtonian physics got modified by gravity or by general relativity. Some kind of modifications going on in the quantum gravity era, but no one would be sane to say we know exactly what's going on. But what's amazing is we can actually constrain it to some degree. So, but I would also say that as we push forward with these measurements, it's not going to give us the quantum gravity answer. It's simply going to help us eliminate a lot of the wrong quantum gravity models.
All right. Thank you, Hugh. Thanks to each of you. Great discoveries. We hope you, the listener, has benefited today from these. You can hear more of this kind of discussion on the Alaska cruise. That's right. You guys are going on another cruise. I'm sure you've been hearing about it, and perhaps you've read about it on our website. If you have not signed up for it, well, we're going to talk about it just briefly here before we leave the podcast. Each of you has a talk that you're preparing for. Maybe we can tease a little bit of that talk. Here are the dates, incidentally, July 1st through the 8th, and you can go on our website, reasons.org. We have a nice button there that you can get all the info on. So if you have not signed up for it, you can get all the pertinent details, including the prices and the various cabins and all that beautiful stuff there. But let's hear the
talks. I was just talking with Fuzz, and we were going to replicate our walk from 4 years ago where we hiked up to the top of Mount Roberts in the rain. You know, so right. Fuzz was just chomping at the bit to get back
up. I'm becoming
unforgettable.
I'm becoming very indoorsy as I get older.
Well, you can do that. It's a big boat.
Yeah. It is. It's a big boat. No, I was joking. It's just it is a... You know, we're going to get a lot of chance to see just some spectacular scenery. We've gone on the Alaskan cruise twice, and it's just the being up in the Tracy Arm, overseeing the glaciers, Juneau, Ketchikan, Skagway. There's just some spectacular scenery, neat stuff.
Inside Passage, they call it.
Yeah, it's a from a just enjoying the beauty of creation. It's one of the better trips I've been on.
And so because we're going the first week of July, you'll be able to see that scenery 24/7. I'm leaving my telescope at home because it's never going to get dark enough to use the telescope. So
the sunlight hours will be all the way up to...
even starting in Vancouver, at that time in July, it never gets completely dark. Wow. You see twilight all night long. Okay. So... Hmm. As you go north, you don't even get the twilight.
So that means you can eat around the clock virtually, huh?
Well, I thought that. Then they close the buffet at 11:30 each night. So,
yeah, but they open it up at 5. So,
all right. No, that's fair.
So that's why you need to climb Mount Roberts, Fuzz, work off some of that great food. Well, in addition to all that, you guys will be presenting talks. Let's hear.
I'm giving a talk on, you know, just looking at a day on another planet and just, you know, some of what we're discovering from these exoplanets and how different they look from Earth and, you know, just kind of highlighting just how remarkable the Earth's capacity is to support life compared to what we're finding as we look outside our solar system.
So why we should be grateful that we're cruising on Earth and not some other planet?
Mm. Well, you might be hard-pressed to find another planet with enough water and land to cruise on, so.
Right.
Okay, good.
I'm going to be giving a talk on the scientific evidence for human exceptionalism, which provides scientific support for the idea that humans are made in the image of God, which is just a key foundational idea that's the heart of the Christian faith. Mm-hmm. And that'll be one talk. Another talk is in the breakout session will be on design for discovery, how... what we've learned about biology indicates that biology was put together in such a way to make the biological realm intelligible, and that this is part of the way in which God is revealing himself to us, but also is a way in which God's providence and his love for humanity is manifested. And then finally, I'll give a talk on my book, Dinosaur Blood in the Age of the Earth.
All right. Okay, good.
Well, you know, Joe, that's one of the features of this cruise that's different from previous cruises. You're going to hear a lot more messages from the scholars that are on board the cruise. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm giving a plenary on how to respond to non-empirical atheist arguments and models, a little bit of what we were talking about just a few minutes ago. And one of my breakouts will be how just right life resolves the faint sun paradox, how the sun gets brighter and brighter, but God creates just the right life at just the right time to compensate for what's happening in the physics of the sun, making the argument you need somebody who actually knows what's going on with the sun to make sure you got the right life at the right time. And my other breakout is going to be how God prepared the universe, the whole universe, to make possible the redemption of billions of human beings.
Terrific. Sounds like great stuff. And as anyone who has been on a previous cruise knows, you guys aren't hiding anywhere. You're accessible to anyone who goes on the cruise. You can have meals with you guys. AJ Roberts, who is not here with us on this podcast, she's working on her book. She'll be going as well.
And one of our visiting scholars is going to be coming on the cruise and speaking.
Abdu Murray. Right. He's with RZIM, right, Fuzz? Yeah, Abdu Murray will be going as well. So it's going to be great. sign up. Go to our website, reasons.org.
And you can ask Fuzz questions about apologetics as you're going up Mount Roberts again.
You're committed to that now, Fuzz, whether you like it or not. What's the elevation of that mountain?
Oh, it's not very high, but it is steep going up. And Fuzz loves to talk when he's going up a steep trail.
All right. So we sure hope to see you there. Again, go to reasons.org. Okay, I think we covered everything for this podcast. Thanks for listening as usual. And you can find the guys on their social media pages, Facebook and Twitter. For Hugh Ross, Fuzz Rana, and Jeff Swearing, this is Joe Aguirre. Thank you for your support. We will see you next time on Scientifica.
We'd like to thank our monthly partners for making this broadcast possible. If you're not a monthly partner or would like information about becoming one, please go to reasons.org/monthly partners. Also, find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter, where you can join the conversation about the latest scientific discoveries, headlines, and their apologetic value.